How will today's FCC vote on so-called net neutrality rules change the way you use the internet? I'm Craig Cohen. Just ahead on Houston Matters, tech editor Dwight Silverman with the Houston Chronicle walks us through the long saga over net neutrality and lays out how FCC policy changes might impact you. Also ahead, the HISD board votes tonight on whether to completely rebuild four Harvey flood-damaged schools. We learn more. The Houston City Council Wednesday did not vote on a new recycling contract. We talk with News 88.7's Andrew Schneider about who and what is holding it up. We examine the history of Texas jailhouse music, and the gang from Ask This Old House comes to town for a special Houston episode.
You look down in the pile of the junk, and it's not really junk, and you see a stack of Polaroids of some memory, some part of somebody's life. Yeah. That'll never reconnect, and it always gets you.
These and other Houston Matters. Follow this hour's news. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. As you just heard, the Federal Communications Commission has just repealed so-called net neutrality rules. Those regulations were created in 2015 to keep broadband companies from blocking or slowing down web content. How will today's vote impact the way you use the internet? Joining us now is Dwight Silverman. He's technology editor for the Houston Chronicle. Dwight, welcome back to the program.
Great. Thanks to be here.
And we welcome you to the conversation as well. It's 713-440-8870 or talk at HoustonMatters.org. You can also send us a tweet. We're on Twitter at Houston Matters. Dwight, first, this is a concept that can be confusing for some. So let's start at the very beginning of all of this. What is net neutrality?
Net neutrality is the idea that all data moving across the internet is equal and needs to be treated as such, so that if I want to watch Netflix, that has exactly the same priority from my internet service provider as when I send an email to my mom.
Has that been the environment under which we all have been living since the development of the internet?
Well, for the most part, it's been a principle up until about 2015, and it was codified into regulations by the Obama-era Federal Communications Commission.
And what did...
They kind of did it in a kludgy fashion in that they took a 1930s-era law that was designed to regulate the telephone company, at which time there was only one, and they applied that to internet providers, essentially saying that they now are common carriers. They're that important in the U.S., and we need to be able to regulate them.
Yeah, I guess for a long time, the question was whether or not the FCC, specifically the Federal Communications Commission, had the authority to regulate anything related to the internet.
Yes, and they essentially, you know, worked those regulations by way of what was called at the time Title II, and took internet service providers out of the information services category and into common carrier. And along with doing that, they said, well, now you can't essentially prioritize content, charge more for faster content. You can't block, you can't throttle, gave essentially a series of rules. And for the past 2 years, we've been living under those regulations.
And I guess a lot of this happens behind the scenes where we as Houstonians, as anybody in the U.S., really just wouldn't know necessarily what is being delivered to us faster or slower for one reason or another.
Yes, and until, of course, if you're on a slower connection and you try to watch Stranger Things on Netflix, you'll feel it then. But, you know, for the most part, we just sit down at our computers or pull our smartphones out of our pockets or these days even, you know, look at it on our wrists and you have internet access and it just flows freely.
What did the FCC vote today then do exactly?
So what it does is it essentially takes the situation back to the way it was before 2015 with a couple of other caveats. One of the things that it does is it turns over to a lot of the enforcement that the FCC had assumed under the 2015 rules. The Federal Trade Commission, while it doesn't necessarily have the technical depth to deal with everything that the FCC might, it has dealt for a long time with privacy cases on the internet, and so it does have some experience there as to how the internet works. It also blocks municipalities and states from creating their own net neutrality rules so that the rules stay the same around the country. And it also requires that internet service providers have more transparency. So, for example, if AT&T wanted to provide faster services, say, to Netflix or charge you more to have a faster connection, you would be able to know it clearly on their website.
FCC Chairman Ajit Pai sparked some controversy protests as well when he announced today's vote just a few weeks ago. Was that announcement a surprise, or was this something that really was coming?
This, pretty much from the beginning of his chairmanship, he had indicated he wanted to do this. It's been kind of a runaway train in terms of policy. And, you know, when he did this, essentially there were no additional public hearings. He crafted his rules along using the FCC staff and then released them a few weeks ago. And it was a foregone conclusion as to what would happen. The FCC's makeup under the Trump administration is three Republicans and two Democrats, and all three of the Republicans voted for the repeal.
And what are the arguments in favor of this repeal?
The arguments in favor of it are that the 2015 rules were heavy-handed and amounted to micromanaging the internet. That's the phrase that Chairman Pai uses. Their arguments is that market forces can take care of it, and that you see that your ISP is doing something that you don't like, you can jump to an internet service provider. The problem with that argument is, of course, that while here in Houston we have several choices, that's not true in a lot of the country where they have only one or maybe one large one and then some smaller ISPs. But they're basically saying market forces are the way to go.
What are the internet service provider options we have here in Houston?
So in Houston, there are two big ones. There's AT&T, and there is Comcast. There are, in a variety of other locations, depending on where you live, some additional ones out in the suburbs. For example, Verizon has its fiber service called Fios in some areas. CenturyLink is available in other parts of Houston. But for the most part, we have a duopoly here.
And these ISPs, there, I gather, in favor of, happy to see this repeal take place.
Yes, they essentially argue that they have been stymied by the regulations. Chairman Pai said that in his document that investment in internet service providers and their infrastructure has declined since 2015. There are some who dispute that, but both Comcast and AT&T and the other providers around the country, you know, say that they will probably be able to do more investment in their infrastructure without these rules.
What then does this all mean for each of us who subscribe to AT&T or Comcast or CenturyLink or Verizon's Fios service? How will we know if they are doing something that actually is intentionally slowing down the delivery of a website or an application or something like that?
Well, the rules from the FCC say that they have to tell you. And, you know, that's whether they do that or not remains to be seen. Chances are you won't see things like slowing down. But what we tend to see is an internet service provider saying, we can guarantee that you'll never see buffering on Netflix if you pay this extra amount. Or what you might see is Netflix saying, you know, we are being charged more to deliver faster content, and so we're going to have to raise rates to you. Those are the kinds of things that you might see. And in the extreme, you might even see internet service become like cable, where you pay for tiers and bundles of service. Let's say that you do a lot of Google searches. You might want to pay extra to have the Google bundle so that you can do all of your searches. That's the kind of thing that you might see. I don't think you'll see anything like tomorrow morning. I don't think anything is going to happen. And it is possible that, particularly since you do have a lot of scrutiny right now on internet service providers, and in a lot of markets like Houston, you have tough competition. No one is going to want to kind of be the first out the door with something that is going to anger a lot of people right now.
Well, let's talk about that public anger. NPR reported about 22 million public comments had been filed with the FCC on this issue. But NPR also reports a study from the Pew Research Center found about 94% of those comments, quote, were submitted multiple times. And in some cases, those comments were submitted many hundreds of thousands of times. So how engaged are people on this? How upset are they or not?
I think that there, as with any issue, there is a large core of people who really care and they are upset. I think all you have to do is dip your toe into technology news sites and policy sites, and I think you'll see a lot of people upset about it. The average person out there probably won't care until their internet access, the price of their internet access goes up. I think a lot of people, you ask them about what net, probably know better now that we've had this debate, but I think the majority of people kind of don't really care at the moment.
We have an email from Doris who notes that Norway's switching to all digital. She wants to know what the implications of this ruling are in nations around the world.
I don't necessarily think it affects other nations. You know, other than that, a lot of people get services from the U.S., for example, you know, Netflix is available in other countries. But in the cases where it's a large provider or a large service provider, they have operations in those countries. So this is for the most part a U.S. thing. The only caveat I would say to that is that it could be that other countries that have net neutrality rules looking at this may consider doing otherwise and following the United States if this works.
You mentioned the potential for an increase to Netflix dues or something like that. Gary's in Baytown, and he, I think, maybe has already seen that effect. Gary, what's your question or comment?
Hello. I got an email from Netflix this week, just yesterday or the day before, saying that our costs are going up and we are going to increase what we charge you for Netflix. And I thought that was a rather coincidental event, this FCC announcement and that upgrade. That's all I've got.
All right. Thanks, Gary. We appreciate it. I will just simply point out I got the same notice from Netflix a couple of weeks ago. So I'm wondering if it was preemptive.
No, that actually was announced earlier this year that they were going to do that. They're simply giving you notice that your next bill will go up by a dollar. And the reason for this is not because of bandwidth costs necessarily, but Netflix more and more is getting into original content as opposed to showing other content that's been created by other providers. And so that's really, really, and they're ramping it up, and they have to compete with the likes of Amazon and other streaming services and Hulu. So that essentially is kind of the cost of having a third season of Stranger Things.
You said internet service providers are still required to inform us if they are making use of the ability to speed up delivery of something or slow down delivery of something. They're supposed to report that. Hal has tweeted and wants to know how consumers will know if that's actually the case. He wants to know, how will we know if slowness is due to throttling versus some other reason, like the website we're trying to access is just slow?
Well, you essentially have to rely with the internet providers on an honor system. You know, initially, I would say that any slowness you see is more than likely going to be because the internet is a really complex place, and there are a lot of variables. Everything from you know, the what's happening along the pipes from the source of the content to your TV, and then even in your own home, if you've got a router and you have a baby monitor can can interfere with your Wi-Fi connection in your home. So there are many, many variables, and it's really hard to know whether or not the internet service providers will do it. Probably it won't just come with, hey, we're going to start blocking and throttling, but there would be some kind of, you know, we're going to start offering you a faster connection if you pay this, and we will slow down the other connections if you stay at that on that service tier. And that's the kind of thing I think that you would see. I don't think you would see it suddenly, and it wouldn't be nefarious. It would be done in an effort to make some more money.
Do you anticipate legal challenges to today's vote?
Oh, yeah. They've already, you know, essentially they've already said we're going to tackle this in the courts. I think a couple of approaches that they might that would be to attack the process. You know, you mentioned the fake comments. There is commenting is actually a part of the rulemaking process, and the way they're done is part of the regulation for the FCC. And I think you could challenge that it wasn't done properly. In addition, the FCC has to make regulations in a manner that is not capricious or arbitrary. And I think that given kind of what happened in 2015 and just going right back to this with a straight out repeal, would give opponents some ammunition in court.
Dwight,
you also could have a shot at some kind of lawmaking. You know, for a long time, people have called for legislation that would clear this up and would make it clear. And I think that you might see that now, particularly after the 2018 elections.
That's Houston Chronicle technology editor Dwight Silverman. Dwight, thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
Still ahead, the Houston City Council's vote on a new recycling contract has been delayed. News 88.7's Andrew Schneider explains why. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. The Houston Independent School District Board tonight will consider if the state's largest district will completely rebuild four elementary schools that suffered serious damage during Harvey. Brian Busby is the chief operating officer for HISD. Brian, welcome to Houston Matters.
Thank you for having me.
Which schools are we talking about?
Well, right now we have seven schools that are currently relocated due to Hurricane Harvey, but the four on tonight's agenda are specifically Scarborough Elementary, Braeburn Elementary, Coulter Elementary, and Mitchell Elementary.
And what was the extent of the damage from Harvey at those schools?
Well, the extent, in a word, was devastation. But basically, we had anywhere from 5 feet to 5 to 10 inches of water that stagnated throughout the entire building for those buildings for days upon a week, before we can get into the neighborhood to be able to access the school to assess damage and start repairs. And once we immediately started repairs per the guidelines that we were set to follow for the natural disaster that was declared, we realized as we were 30% into the work that we were, in essential lack of better terms, throwing good money after bad based on the age of these facilities.
How would this plan impact students and staff at these schools if you decide, okay, we absolutely need to rebuild these schools from scratch? What does that mean for students and staff at those schools?
Well, I mean, honestly, students and staff have been relocated since the start of school on the modified start dates that we had. So they're excited because in their minds, okay, I'm getting a new building. But what this means from a public standpoint is, without a bond referendum or without raising taxpayers' taxes, we're going into reserve funds and our TERS funds to put 21st century facilities in these community-based schools, because these schools are enrolled with kids from the areas of their surrounding neighborhoods.
Do you anticipate you'll need additional funding, a bond or something like that, to make this happen, or you can use those reserve funds?
No. We're basically programming a not-to-exceed amount of around $30 to $32 million per campus, not to exceed for the entire four, $126 million. And anything we need above and beyond that, the chief financial officer and I are working hand in hand to not have to go back to the board for additional funds.
How long might it take to do this, to build four new schools, essentially?
Typically, it takes you between 14 to 16 months. But we're trying to expedite some of those processes and procurement methods by using the construction manager at risk style of procurement. So we're looking at this taking us no more than 17 months total before they're able to move in the building. Construction time, 15 months.
So certainly these students and teachers, they won't be returning to these new schools next school year, but maybe the year after?
The target date for them to return back into their new buildings is January or the spring of 2020.
Okay. In what other ways has Harvey impacted the school district so far this year?
I mean, countless. I mean, there are people on the personal side that have totally lost homes. Through the McKinney-Vento Act, we've experienced the loss of students that had to relocate because where FEMA or housing support would house them because their homes were lost. And we've taken in students as well that have had to relocate from other areas to come into Houston for new homes or housing for a period of time. So it's affected that piece. It's also affected people's school of thought on what a rain event is in Houston, because we've all experienced flooding in the past, but never in the history of Texas have we experienced Harvey. So we're more aware there. We all have a heightened awareness of people's emotions during this time as people recover from what they experienced and the trauma and the realness that no matter what your zip code was, your socioeconomic background, your ethnicity, or your financial status, everybody equally got impacted by Harvey, and everybody at that time, it didn't matter what you were, who you were, if you were being rescued, you didn't stop the rescuer to say, you know, are you rich or poor? Are you Republican or Democrat? I mean, it was basically all hands on deck from a Houston Strong perspective.
Brian Busby is Chief Operating Officer for the Houston Independent School District. Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Up in the morning and out to school.
At Wednesday's Houston City Council meeting, council members were originally scheduled to vote on the city's new recycling contract. They didn't. That's because City Controller Chris Brown announced he would not certify the contract, at least not yet. News 88.7 politics and government reporter Andrew Schneider joins us now to explain why. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Why did Controller Brown decide he couldn't yet sign off on this contract?
Well, he said that he was concerned, among other things, about the transparency of the process by which the company FCCSA got the contract. And he said he was also worried about the company's proposed subcontractor, Taylor Smith Consulting, which, among other reasons, he said was because that they're now subject to a handful of lawsuits, including three under the Fair Labor Standards Act.
This is not the first stumbling block on the way to this particular recycling deal. Can you walk us through what's happened over the last several months?
Oh, yeah. Well, the city government's actually been trying to close a new recycling contract for more than a year. The Turner administration and the old contractor, Waste Management, couldn't come to terms. They had a very messy blow-up. So then they went through a bidding process, which led to the contract being awarded to FCC in July. And immediately that led to a backlash from several members of the city council who said they had a problem with the bidding process. They claimed it wasn't fair enough and it wasn't open. So they wound up postponing the vote they were supposed to take back then. It then went to a second round of bidding, which FCC won again, this time with a bid for about $10 million lower than the previous one.
What sort of authority does Controller Brown have to hold up a contract like this?
All that he needs. I mean, he's the city's chief financial officer. So his job is, among other things, he's the city's financial watchdog. So he's responsible for auditing city departments and federal grant programs. But more to the point here, he has to sign off on the availability of funds before the city council can vote to spend the money. So without his say-so, that vote just can't go forward. And that was what happened here.
Are there any limits to that authority? I mean, could he just decide he just doesn't like the deal and won't sign off and that's the end of it?
No. He has to have a reason. I mean, bear in mind, he hasn't said that he's not ultimately going to sign for this. The reason that he said so in this case, in terms of the letter that he provided explaining his reasoning, was that there were several sets of procurement documents related to the deal, which were in City Hall and which he says were only kept on paper, and they were subsequently destroyed during Harvey. His investigators need to conduct a review based on some of the ongoing concerns, which he says still haven't been satisfied. And he's you know, he's not clear how long that investigation is going to take, but it, you know, it's not by any means predetermined that ultimately he's going to say no. All it means is that he needs to be satisfied that this deal is above board before he's willing to sign off on it.
If he does sign off, do we have any sense now on when the council might then vote on the contract?
It could, at the very least, it's not going to be until January. I mean, that was certainly the sense that I got at the meeting. You know, there were still, I think, several. The mayor himself has basically said he doesn't see what the problem is, that the documents in question were ones that Controller Brown had actually approved back before the deal in July, that he, you know, that they were regarding the original contract. And as far as the other charge here, as far as the lawsuits that are going on against the subcontractor, the mayor's argument was, look, I mean, if you disqualified any contractor on the basis of lawsuits against them, you would wind up ruling out just about everybody. So far, these are lawsuits, but they are not judgments against the firm. So this could wind up going forward conceivably in a month's time. But again, the controller has not given any kind of deadline for how long his investigation is going to take.
Andrew Schneider keeps tabs on the Houston City Council for News 88.7. You can follow him on Twitter at @Schneider_HPM. Andrew, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Controller Brown's father, former Houston City Council member Peter Brown, died Tuesday. Chris Brown made that announcement on Twitter, explaining his father passed away after a long battle with cancer. Peter Brown distinguished himself as an advocate for urban planning and pedestrian safety. While serving on the City Council in 2008, he helped kick off the city's new general plan website, where citizens could get information about city regulations.
It's the ultimate in transparent government. You know, because you can hold the plan up and you can say to the citizens, thank you for your tax money, and you want to know why we're spending it and where we're spending it and how we're spending it. It's based on the vision and the goals and the policies that are stated in this plan.
In 2009, Brown ran unsuccessfully for mayor. At a candidates forum, he spoke in favor of light rail expansion and transit-oriented development.
There are good examples in other cities. We're probably 15 years behind Dallas in expanding our light rail system, and we're behind Denver now. Dallas has about 30 transit-oriented development projects going. We need some real aggressive leadership on transit-oriented development and expansion of our rail transit in Houston.
And in 2011, while Brown served as director of the nonprofit organization Better Houston, he spoke in favor of improvements to Washington Avenue.
What's, in my view, really important is that we have not a theoretical plan, but a very practical plan, something that will lead to a more orderly, more coherent, more walkable and mixed-use urban development.
A memorial service will be held next Thursday at St. John the Divine Episcopal Church in remembrance of former city council member and mayoral candidate Peter Brown, who passed away this week. He was 81. Just ahead, a little Texas jailhouse music, and later, Ask This Old House comes to town. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen.
Oh, Bobby cried, poor thing she moaned. Oh, what whooping and hollering. I know you're sick, you're very pale. Young man, you're slowly dying.
That's a 1933 recording of a song called Barbara Allen. It's by a musician named Moses Clear Rock Platt. At the time, Platt was an inmate in a state prison near Sugar Land. He was just one of many incarcerated in Texas who learned to play musical instruments and performed as part of a rehabilitation program in the 1920s and 30s. Their stories are told in a book called Texas Jailhouse Music, A Prison Band History. It's by Caroline Nagy. Last year, Nagy told Houston Matters' Michael Haggerty that the program, which was used in prisons in places like Huntsville and Brazoria, started as a PR tactic.
So we're talking about a lot of prisoners that received harsh sentences for not maybe the most harsh, not all of them at least, the most harsh crimes. And they had a large population, about 6,000 in the Texas system in the 1930s, and about 150 of those were women. So the Texas prison system was looking for a way to improve their image in the public eye. Unfortunately, you know, there were a lot of newspaper reports about the brutal acts that were happening, a lot of really terrible things that were going on. It was a harder time. So they were looking to sort of rehabilitate themselves in the eyes of the public, and also to just sort of, you know, say, we are trying to rehabilitate these inmates. And so they definitely used the radio show 30 Minutes Behind the Walls, which began in 1938, as a tool, a public relations tool. And the inmates were part of that. But of course, you're talking about somebody who lives in a really brutal environment being able to be given a guitar or a mandolin or a banjo and just say, learn this, let's get something going. And it gives them a sense of accomplishment. So that's something important to take away, I think.
Tell me about this radio show, 30 Minutes Behind the Walls.
It started airing in March 24th, 1938, and it was one of the first regular weekly shows. It aired from WBAP in Fort Worth, starting at that time, which was at that point a 50,000-watt clear channel radio station that basically you could hear it in Canada and Mexico and Hawaii and a lot of the islands. So they got thousands and thousands of fan letters. They aired every Wednesday at 10:30 p.m., and they received so many accolades. And it was also a chance for the prison officials, including the governors of Texas, various governors of Texas, to give speeches and talk about the programs that they were developing.
But then these musicians who were in prison, incarcerated, would perform then and play their songs on the radio then.
That's right. And it actually was really integrated. I mean, considering this is Jim Crow era of a southern prison farm-based prison system, it's a really nice example of inmate integration. You know, there was a lot of highlighting for the African-American inmates and some of the Mexican-American inmates, the women, some of the minorities really got a chance to shine on the radio.
Tell me about some of these people. Who are some of these performers and the acts that they were in?
Well, I have various different people that I focus on in different chapters. One of the bigger narratives that I have was a young woman. Her name was Rebel Childs, and she was serving time for a murder that was happened to her husband. She was basically incarcerated for conspiracy to murder, but she was very charismatic, classy individual. All across the board, reports from the prison officials, they loved her. Even remember hearing that one of the prison officials, they were looking to set her up with their brother, you know, because they really sympathized towards her. And she was one of the few who had children that came out of the prison system, and she was able to tell her daughter about that experience. And her daughter actually lives in Houston. So I've spoken with her and really been able to round out this narrative for something that would be long ago forgotten.
So tell me about a couple other of the artists that stood out to you.
Well, one gentleman by the name of Raymond Hall, who was in prison for life. He really did not get out for many, many decades. He was a musician, a songwriter in the prison system. He actually met the father of country music. He's known as the father of country music, Jimmy Rogers. He met him when they were working the rails together in the 1920s. And then when Jimmy Rogers became famous, Halls wrote to him, and they struck up a correspondence. Halls became a popular songwriter for Jimmy Rogers, and writing including the prison song. And many people think of country music, think of Merle Haggard and Mama Tried and Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison. And a lot of this really concept of the prison and country music originated with this gentleman who was in the Texas prison system writing for a man who helped define the genre.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty talking with Caroline Nagy, author of Texas Jailhouse Music, a Prison Band History. So we've got a couple examples of some of the music. Tell me about some of these tracks and the artists performing.
One of the ladies that we have recordings of, her name is Hattie Ellis. We found out that John Lomax had recorded her in 1939 when he went on the Texas prison system. At that point, the radio show was already going on. And although Lomax was really looking for folk songs, I think that they probably said, listen to this woman, she's incredible. And when you hear the recordings, her voice is really haunting. Well, I'm There's also a fellow by the name of A.B. Johnson. He was also, I think his prison nickname or maybe his regular nickname was Ace Johnson. And he was a harmonica player. And he was a very frequent performer on 30 Minutes Behind the Walls, especially in its early years. And he would go on and he would play the harmonica and he would sing and he would punctuate his singings with hollers and shouts. Really great stuff. I mean, it feels so organic. And his song that he recorded for Lomax was called Rabbit in the Garden, and it's just incredible stuff.
Rabbit, get up in the hollow. Rabbit, got him out of heaven, going in my garden, eating them cabbage.
Did any of these musicians, how did it change their lives getting this opportunity? Did any of them go on to work in music after prison if they got out, any of that?
Well, some of them actually were quite accomplished prior to going in. Not many. The majority of them learned their instruments and learned performance while they were incarcerated. There are a couple of really isolated instances that I found where somebody did it afterwards, but particularly for the women, but also for the men. By and large, I think they weren't about to advertise that they were the former Gory all-girls string band, so they really kind of hid it. Rebel Childs in particular never really told her daughter until she was much older that she had done that and performed in the prison band. But I think that while they were in, it was the highlight of what they were, you know, dealing with. I think it's very important for rehabilitation in the prison systems, like on a larger scale. I wanted to tell this historical story as a way to highlight what can be done and what has been done in prison systems. And I think that it can be brought into a more modern, you know, place by updating, you know, the programs here and rehabilitating in many different correctional facilities. I think that it would just help the inmates feel a sense of self in systems which tend to depersonalize the experience completely, give them a chance to shine.
Is there one more artist and song we can play to play us out?
Sure. Well, actually, a lot of people have heard of Lead Belly, and they heard about him. If they know his story, they know that John Lomax took him out of not the Texas prison, but the Louisiana prison, and took him on the road with him. Later, like the year later, he took out one other inmate, and that inmate was named James Ironhead Baker. And we have a recording here of him singing Go Down, Old Hannah, which was a very common work song sung in the penitentiaries of the South, not just Texas. But it's really an incredible, spiritually fulfilling tune that really gets down into your bones.
Go down, oh Hannah, don't you rise no more. Go down, oh Hannah.
Caroline, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Caroline Nagy is the author of Texas Jailhouse Music, A Prison Band History. She spoke with Houston Matters' Michael Haggerty.
My name is Brandy Tarver. I'm a licensed professional counselor and a licensed marriage and family therapist. I have been also trained on Bringing Baby Home, which is a workshop geared towards helping couples make the transition successfully from being a couple to parents. So some of the challenges that people find once they have a baby, sex life decreases in the relationship. There's less communication. Now everything is about baby, which is a really hard transition for some people. There are a lot of physical changes that women go through, emotional changes as well, and we can't always predict whether we're going to experience these certain changes, so it's really nice to be prepared for those kinds of things. So some of the changes that men typically experience, you know, it used to be about me and my wife or me and my partner. Now I'm not part of the main formula, if you will. Now men are like, what is my role? I used to be her main man. Now I'm not. Now she's consumed with baby. How do I fit into this picture? What's my role? A lot of times we find that men kind of get, unfortunately, pushed out in some ways. Think about it. In the hospital, we're attending to mom. The baby comes in to feed. It's about mom and baby. You know what I mean? So men are limited in some ways with their role, but this workshop gives them the opportunity to talk to their significant other before baby comes so that women can really honor what the men want their role to be like. I mean, babies are beautiful, and they come with so many wonderful things, you know. At the same time, there is less sleep, so we're not as patient as we might always be. And then conflict starts happening. If they take a workshop like this, though, they can be prepared for that. They'll get tools in this workshop to help in that exact moment. My name is Brandy Tarver, and I hold the Bringing Baby Home workshop. And you're listening to Houston Matters.
Last month, the cast of This Old House came to Houston to tape a special edition of their spinoff show, Ask This Old House, centered on homes that were affected by Harvey. Houston Matters producer Joshua Zinn met up with the crew at Eleanor Tinsley Park to talk about what they hope to accomplish with the special.
I'm Kevin O'Connor, and I'm host.
I'm Tom Silver, and they call me a contractor.
Richard Trithewey, all things mechanical.
Roger Cook, anything to do with the ground and soil.
So, Kevin, I want to start with you. What is Ask This Old House doing in Houston?
So we're here working on several different houses. Each one of these guys has a story, and the sort of spin for us is we've done hurricane projects before. We are often 6 months, 1 year, or 2 years after the storms and are doing rebuilding. What these guys are talking about here is what do you do sort of immediately after the storm? Those pressing questions when a homeowner is trying to figure out, is the house habitable? What does get saved? How do I actually clean it out? And we're going to do a little bit of rebuilding in the process too.
Yeah, so Tom, you said there each of you has a different story. So, you know, summarize, what's your story?
Well, realistically, people don't know whether or not they should tear the house down or whether or not if it's salvageable. I mean, you got to look at the structural damages of the house. You got to look at the mold issues, and you got to figure out, you know, how bad it is. In a lot of cases, it's just cheaper, easier, and faster to rip it down and start fresh.
And Richard, what about you?
We did the alternative to that story where this faith-based group came, they have volunteers, and came in and did a mud out to go in and clean out the building and then to go back in step two and disinfect and kill all the mold and really show the process. It's unbelievably graphic to see your entire life and history out in the front lawn. I mean, I don't have to tell anybody in Houston. It was crazy. It was unbelievable story.
And Roger?
I worked with a nonprofit group that actually gets the tools to the volunteers. All these people come down, 40, 50, 100 of them, and they have no tools to work with. This place will lend them out at a very, very low rate. In fact, if it's hurricane damage, they'll give them to you for free to use, and then you bring them back. Mm-hmm. No sense getting all the volunteers down here without anything for them to work with.
Right. And you mentioned that you've worked with hurricane projects before. You've had to deal with different disaster zones. From what you're seeing here, is there anything unique about this situation and about what you've seen after Harvey?
I think it's always unique. I mean, you walk into someone else's community and you sort of meet the people who are displaced, and that makes it very unique and very personal. The scale of it, I think, is startling as well. I mean, we were down after Katrina and after Sandy, and so these things are always very catastrophic. This is a big place, though. There's a lot of houses affected, a lot of square mileage, and that's one of the most shocking things to see.
Yeah, I mean, the damage that's done by the wind and the rain and the water is one thing, but the residual that's in that water that's left after the water leaves is disgusting, and it's got to go, you know, and people don't even think about that.
Every time I go to one of these places, there's one thing that always catches me. You look down in the pile of the junk, and it's not really junk, and you see a stack of Polaroids of some memory, some part of somebody's mm-hmm. life
yeah.
that'll never reconnect, and it always gets you. It really does always get you, and this is no different.
We were always touched, too, by the passion of the people who come back and rebuild and help other people rebuild. And it's just amazing to see what's going on here.
Yeah. People want to help people. I mean, it's just in you.
Yeah.
And it's good to be part of it. It's good to show it.
Yeah. And so I think one thing that some people might be concerned about is the time, especially because, you know, we're talking about you guys are here after the fact. You know, we had Harvey back in August, September, and we're now well into November, but people are still having to deal with this. How long does it take to get back on your feet and get your house back to where you want it to be?
Some cases, years.
Yeah. We were with this group yesterday, and we asked that question, saying, you know, it's been 2 months, this house has been tightened up, and they said, look, we're a volunteer organization, we got 200 people out of whack, but it takes time to just slowly get it back. And it could be 2 years, it could be 3 years. Because there's also the cost of it. You know, I don't have to tell anybody the cost of rebuilding.
The manpower, and you got to make sure that even though you're putting it back, you got to put it back correctly, because you don't want to end up with more problems, and more issues with mold and all that kind of stuff that you have to be aware of.
The line is it's going to go on for a while, and people should realize that the help you're giving now is great, but people are going to need help months and years from now.
When you're coming to a new place like this, what is the process for deciding where to go? How do you pick the families of the houses that you're going to decide eventually to work on and then feature in the show?
Good producers. We've got a team that is on the ground making calls, talking to, you know, in this case, some of the charitable organizations, talking to the city, talking to the PBS stations locally for contact, and you're out there and you're looking for, I mean, sadly, there's no shortage of possibilities out here, but you still have to kind of coordinate in terms of logistics. And that is a production job, and we've got some really good producers that are just trying to fill up a lot of stories for us day in and day out.
This one particularly came from a project we did for Ask in Nashville, Tennessee, where we got three or four different stories out of that house, and then we're talking to the homeowner and asked what she did, and she said, well, I'm part of a relief organization, and she started telling about what she was doing here in Houston, and then all of a sudden that invited us to meet a lot of the people, and we got here. So it's all networking through what we do.
And so for you three, since you're focusing on specific families, you know, there might still be other families out there or houses that still need help. What's just some general advice you might give to somebody that's still dealing with hurricane damage after Harvey?
Well, I guess the first thing I want to say is, you know, a lot of people think that they can do the demolition themselves. And demolition can be very tricky. It can be very dangerous. Not only do you have to worry about some structural integrity of the building falling on you, something coming down or stepping on a nail, breaking it, you can break a wrist or an ankle real easy, but you got to be careful of the situation with the mold and mildew getting in the air, and you know it can cause respiratory problems, so you've got to be careful. You got to make sure that you're wearing the right type of respirator, even the white one. There's all different types of chemicals that are in the air that you have to be aware of, and not all the respirators will protect you against those. Then, you know, they say, well, I can go in and do this and do that, and you're better off leaving it to someone that knows what they're doing to get it done right.
I spent the day yesterday in a mold-filled house that had been sealed up for 2 months with gear on, and I'm still feeling a tickle in my, you know, it's caustic. It's a caustic environment.
Yeah.
The other thing is there's a temptation to get it done quickly. You know, you want to get back in your house. Everyone would want to be back in their house, but if you don't do it right, you don't take the time, it's going to come back to haunt you in the long run. So get good advice and do it the right way.
Mm-hmm. Once you're all done here, once you kind of finish everything up, what's the ideal scenario? What do you hope that you get done, and what do you hope that you're able to accomplish while you're here?
I think it's really just bringing people awareness of how bad situations are, and to get all the help and volunteers, and really to tell people to do it the right way. Don't cut corners, because if you only, you know, for example, cut the wall up so high, you think it might be good, but you don't know what's in the wall up above. In some cases, you have to remove more than you think. And I think that's just something that a homeowner doesn't know.
We're not going to make a dent with the number of houses that need to be worked on. So our job is, you know, good information to as many people as possible, showing folks the right way to do it, connecting them with resources. We'll be in and out, and folks will be here left to deal with this for months or years. And so doing it right is important, and that's our goal, is just to show high quality information for the folks.
Impart a little touch of hope you know, for the viewer.
Yeah, just, you know, we're through four guys. We'll do as much as we can, but we'd like people. This isn't over here. This isn't over. This is just beginning here, and there's a long transition to go.
Well, guys, thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The cast of Ask This Old House talking with Houston Matters' Joshua Zinn. You can see video of Josh's conversation with them from Eleanor Tinsley Park at HoustonMatters.org. And that's it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Michael Haggerty, Maggie Martin, Abner Fletcher, and Joshua Zinn. We had help today from Allison Lee. Tom Carter's our technical director. On tomorrow's show, just in time for holiday travel, we welcome your questions about the rules of the road. Also, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the week's news, and a chat with Peter Sellers. Not that Peter Sellers, the other one, the American Opera and Theater director. I'm Craig Cohen. Join us tomorrow for those and other Houston Matters.
Houston Public Media.